Our next town hall. In big money and politics, can your voice count? From Sheldon Silver to Michael Grimm, political corruption is becoming so commonplace that it's hard for voters to feel they have a voice. Is there a way for the average citizen to have a say in a pay-to-play system? Panelists include Letitia James, public advocate for New York City, Dick Dady, executive director of Citizens Union, Doug Henwood, economic journalist, Al Vann, former New York State Assemblyman and City Councilman, and others. Once again, that's 7 to 9 p.m. Wednesday, April 8th.
Previous program was the Juliana Forlano Show, heard every, Monday through Thursday at 6 p.m. here on WBAI. As mentioned before, both Off the Hook and the Personal Computer Show are preempted tonight for a very special town hall meeting presented by Brooklyn Independent Media. And the name of this town hall meeting, once again, is Big Money and Politics. And it will be moderated by Brian Vines, senior producer at Brooklyn Independent Media. And once again, you'll be able to hear this simulcast live here on WBAI 99.5 FM. Well, let me get the station ID right. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned for this special town hall meeting. Here we go.
Culture producer for The Takeaway.
And I'm Rafer Guzman, movie critic for Newsday.
And you're watching Brooklyn Public Network.
Hello and welcome to this Brick Community Town Hall. Tonight we're going to be discussing a very important topic. It's big money and politics. Can your voice count? It's a small question that's a really, really big deal, as evident by the people who've assembled on the stage this evening at our invitation and our town, which we're so happy to see that you've come here tonight to discuss this with us. We've had a series of town halls here at Brick. The first was about policing communities of color in the wake of lots of incidents that had happened and the social mobilization that took place in Brooklyn and around the country. And the second of the series was about gentrification and its impact on the place where we live. So the through line there was very clear, and we've arrived here tonight talking at big money and politics. Now that line might be a little harder to thread for some of you, me probably being the number one, because when it was brought up, I said, no one's coming to that. But you all proved me wrong, and you're here, and you're watching or listening on our partner in this broadcast, WBAI Radio. We thank them for simulcasting this. So if you're just tuning in, whether you're on the telly or you're listening on the radio or looking online, call up a friend and tell them that you have the opportunity to be enlightened. Because I'm a recent convert, and like the recently converted, I'm really into this subject right now, because I found a way in last night, in no small part, thanks to the people sitting on the stage now. So I'm going to introduce them to you. First, Across from me is New York City's public advocate and former city council member, Ms. Letitia James. Next to public advocate James is Doug Henwood. He is a journalist. Hey, clap already. Right, Doug. You read his stuff, now you get to see the face that goes with it. Doug Henwood is a journalist, an economic journalist, who writes about the intersection of politics and money and all that fun stuff. Real life, stranger than fiction. And next to Doug, of course, we have the man who's Dick Dady. He's the executive director of Citizens Union, New York's oldest good government watchdog. Thank you for the work, and thank you for being here, Dick. And the next man is here bringing a little comic relief and some serious commentary as well. He's Ted Alexandro, a political activist as well as an entertainer and comedian. Thanks for being here, Ted.
My pleasure, thank you.
And of course, you recognize this man here from his long record of public service at the state and city levels, Mr. Al Vann, who proudly represented, before he left the city council, proudly represented Brooklyn in the 36th district. My home. Thank you, Mr. Vann, for being here. And the person to my immediate left is a professor at Fordham University, and she's also a 2014 gubernatorial candidate, and she's also the author of this book in my hands, Corruption in America. She is Zephyr Teachout. So I made a confession just a while ago that I was not very into this topic. It's like, guys, how do we go from racing and police at this Ferguson, Eric Garner moment? How do we go from gentrification when my rent just went up to big money in politics? That's not the sexiest water cooler thing. But you guys are all smarter than me, so I'm going to start with you, public advocate, and ask, how does big money and politics infiltrate us where we live every day in ways big or small we might not even realize?
So first, let me thank BRIC and WBAI for sponsoring this, and to all of my friends out there in the audience. And just to, Brian, to make it relevant and to spark your interest, I would not be here but for campaign financing. I would not be the public advocate of the city of New York. Campaign finance creates a level playing field. And the reality is that our system of government is broken. And it's broken because of the influence of big money. You see, when I ran for office, a lot of the individuals in the audience supported me. But they're not millionaires and billionaires. Well, I don't think so. And so they gave $5 and they gave $10. But I was outspent almost 6-1. And so if you want the voice of everyday New Yorkers, individuals who care about the crisis in affordable housing, gentrification, community policing, if you want more women and more people of color and more everyday individuals, individuals who just really fundamentally believe that government can be used for good, then we've got to remove the big money and the influence that big money has, because right now they have hijacked our government.
See what happens when you start telling the truth.
And that was see there. So anyway.
All right. Are we good? I don't hear myself.
Are we okay? Did I do something wrong?
Okay. We hope you're not wearing headphones in WBAI.
Okay.
If you are, we apologize for that. We're getting ourselves together. So the public advocate was outspent 6-1. I think you may have her beat, Zephyr.
Oh yes.
So tell us about how. Good guys, I'm gonna borrow your microphone. Tell us about how big money influences our everyday lives.
It influences everything. Actually, when you were talking, I was thinking about what Stephen Colbert said about net neutrality, which is, if you want to do something really evil, make it boring. Make it be the kind of thing people don't want to talk about. But the truth is, we can't talk about gentrification without talking about money and politics, because look at the power of a handful of real estate interests that have hijacked our city.
Right.
You can't talk about the future of our energy policy without talking about money and politics, because there is so much invested in gas, coal, trying to keep us back from a solar energy, renewable energy future. You can't talk about education policy without talking about money and politics. Because, right, I mean, this past year, a handful, basically four hedge fund managers spent millions and millions of their own dollars to try to control education policy in New York State. And unfortunately, in a lot of ways, they succeeded. Not just how much money we're getting, but the way in which that money is spent, the way in which teachers are evaluated, that's being driven by a handful of big donors. So the public advocate is exactly right. We have a broken system. We cannot have a private financing system and actually have self-governance. We have to move away from private financing altogether. So if you think it's not affecting you, it's affecting you so much you can't even see it.
Well, you hit on gentrification. Can you guys hear me? Okay. You hit on gentrification, clean energy, schooling. We got to leave something for the guys up here. I'm going to go to Ted and ask you. You hold up this mirror to ourselves and make us laugh at these things, but what is something that is insidious in all of the money and politics right now?
Well, I think, you know, like has been articulated and was part of the Occupy movement, the sense that all our grievances are connected. And because the money is so entrenched and really does influence everything, you can point to any of the movements that are going on, not only domestically, but internationally. You know, certainly the Black Lives Matter movement. When you talk about money in politics, you're talking about money that goes towards racist policing policies that target poor communities of color that, you know, I think in Ferguson, they had more citations written than actually people were living there, the population. So that's money. That's money in politics. That's policies that are targeting folks in a specific community in the interest of making money. And all of that goes under the umbrella of austerity or neoliberalism. And again, to take it internationally, we're seeing that whether it's in Greece, fortunately, we're seeing, you know, pushback with the election of Syriza in Spain, Podemos in Ireland with the water taxes. People are fighting back there. So I don't see this as just a domestic issue. I think because we're talking about a global economy and globalization, we have to think as a movement globally because they're attacking across the globe.
So, Doug, you do this every day for a living. You have to find some way to make people see that it affects them where they live.
Well, where they live, literally. I mean, I didn't really realize you had an earlier session on gentrification, so I'm going to touch on that a little bit. But we're sitting in the midst of what is really the engineered upscaling of a good bit of Brooklyn. And, you know, people often look at the streetscape or the landscape around them and think this is just spontaneous market forces. But if you look, take a close look at what's been happening in and around this neighborhood over the last couple of decades, really, what you see is a very deliberate plan to, it started in the Koch years in the 80s, to extend the central business district out of Manhattan into downtown Brooklyn, also with the Long Island City. That's proceeding less successfully. But the downtown Brooklyn part is succeeding quite well. And the idea was to redevelop the commercial areas there, to put in high-rises, residential high-rises, offices, redo the Fulton Mall. You can see this in the 1987 plan that the Koch people published called New York Ascendant. And then it continued into the 90s and beyond with the Bloomberg administration, and now it continues today. So you see the development of City Point just off the Fulton Mall. And all these things are not accidents. They are planned by a combination of real estate interests operating through things like the Downtown Brooklyn Partnership, also with the city government through the Economic Development Corporation, which is a very murky entity that people don't really know much about. Now, the head of de Blasio's city planning department is Carl Weisbrod, who ran the Economic Development Corporation at one point, and earlier ran the Trinity Church real estate portfolio and also the upscaling of Times Square. So he is like a walking embodiment of the way that government, real estate, and financial interest all work together to produce this gentrification. It's not just happening by accident. And I'm sorry to say that the arts are also an important part of this scheme. We're sitting in what the planners are now calling the Brooklyn Cultural District. BAM is at the center of it, but also BRIC is also a part of it. There are several other major institutions around here, the Mark Morris Company. And the idea is, you know, to create... I love the arts, I love BRIC, I love BAM, but you know, the way that real estate people see it as a way of lubricating this process of upscaling. Now, since this stuff is not spontaneous, since it's planned, but done very murkily with very little public input, I think we need to think about how ordinary citizens can get a hold of this process. So much goes on behind closed doors. They hold, the Economic Development Corporation will hold hearings, but after decisions have been made, and it's just all pro forma and ritualistic. So you need some kind of way to counter that organized power for an energized public.
Thank you, Doug.
Which I don't see yet, but we need that.
Well, I'd like to think we're at the center of that cultural arts district, but that being said, we're going to move on and ask you, Dick, about this influence of money in our everyday lives.
Sure. I mean, what's been interesting to see happen over the last couple of decades with the rise of special interests and big money and interest trying to influence government decisions, we've seen a precipitous drop in the number of voters turning out and participating. I don't think necessarily there's a cause and effect, but that's something that needs to be examined, and that we are not you know, taking control of the opportunities that we have as New Yorkers to vote. New York State, in its most recent election, was the 45th or 46th state in voter turnout. We're at the bottom of the barrel in the country in terms of the number of voters, eligible voters coming out and voting. And why is that? I think people may feel a sense of powerlessness, a sense that they're not able to influence the decisions. But by not voting, we're giving up. And what we need to do is take a look at ways in which we can engage people more in our democracy. In terms of how real this you know, influence is taking place in New York, you know, we just passed a state budget, $150 billion state budget. And in the governor's proposed budget, there was no mention of a tax credit for buyers of luxury yachts. But there was a proposal for raising the minimum wage, which now, as I think, is $8.75, is going to go up to $9 next year. And out of nowhere in the last couple of days, up pops this tax credit for luxury yacht owners. And the minimum wage dropped off the table. Right. And, you know, there may be an argument, there may be an economic argument that we need to make sure that yachts are built here in New York State. But for there not to have been any attention given to the real issue of needing to raise the minimum wage. I mean, Governor Cuomo proposed $10.50. You know, there are other proposals out there to raise it to a living wage of $15. I mean, it's just outrageous that, you know, one side of the equation is being addressed, money and interest like that, and people who are struggling in this city who need an increase in the minimum wage have been ignored so far.
Yeah. So you're the senior statesman, Mr. Van. How does big money affect your constituents in Bed-Stuy?
Well, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Fred Douglas. But that's not the quote that's applicable tonight. There was another gentleman who lived in the 19th century, referred to as Lord Acton, I believe. And he made some rather profound statements during his time. In fact, he could have lived in the 21st century because you know his quote. He said, power corrupts. No, he said power tends to corrupt. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. I'm glad he put that tens in there because there is a little hope there that there can be a difference, there can be a change. I want to go back. Sometimes you have to go back to go ahead. Elected officials are a very unique status in our society because they're the only ones that get their job by getting elected. You can be a doctor, you can be an engineer, physicist, city worker, whatever. You don't get elected to those jobs. So there should be a bond or a trust because you are representing people. And they have a power. What's that power? The power of the elected officials is that they can affect everybody else in society. No other job, no other profession can do that through taxation, right? Through regulations, right? Or through the budget priorities in terms of how they're going to spend the taxpayers' money. And because they have this unique power, guess what? They're sought after. They're pursued. Because if you have an interest and you want to enhance your interests, and it can be done by affecting those who make those decisions, then you'll find a way to get to them. So, you know, elected officials, those who are alleged to have been corrupt, those who have been found to be corrupt, they don't have a special corrupt gene. You know, it's not in their DNA necessarily. It could be any of us sitting in this town hall meeting, right? But because of the position that they hold and the power that they have, they are going to be tempted. They're going to be tempted. And we live in America, capital America. What's the most motivating force in America? Money, right? And so money and those who have it will use that money to influence whatever legislative body, whatever, to try and satisfy their needs and satisfy their means. So there has to be two to tango. You got money you want to influence, somebody has to accept that money.
Yeah.
Right? And so I like to get to the next step, but I'm going to stop and I really want to go around. I want to whet your appetite and say, well, where is he coming from and what's next?
So speaking about the money that comes into politics, we have a very interesting graph about money that was spent on the elections of 2012 that we're going to be putting up in a second. But the chart will show, and it's coming up now, that there was about 1.8, that 1,800 that you see, this is federal lobbying expenditures and campaign contributions by the financial sector. And this is what Elizabeth Warren has been talking about. This is down in Wall Street. 2014, lobbyists and campaign contributors, that's about $1.4 billion with the B dollars that we see there. So I'm taking it back just a little from 2014 to 2012, the last time we had a presidential election. $2 billion spent by the Romney and Obama campaigns by the time it was all told. What does $2 billion get you?
Mm. Woo! Interesting.
Well, right now, I mean, it's a great chart. It's a terrible chart, but it's a great chart because it's not just that it's the financial sector. This right. financial sector is unbelievably concentrated. This is not tens of thousands of community banks who are all coming together who want to make sure they serve the lending needs of their community. This is a handful of powerful, primarily men, who are using their power, their corporate power and their money power to control policy.
Right.
And they're doing it through lobbying, which then, you know, you basically put it into, you pay lobbyists to almost act as middlemen, sometimes almost as bagmen. They go and they say, here's the policy interests we have. And then the candidate says, here's the fundraising needs I have. They don't need to have an explicit quid pro quo to have an exchange. And I was very involved in the 2009-2010 Dodd-Frank trying to push back on, actually have real reform after the financial crisis of 2008. And I will tell you, they were spending $365 for every dollar we were spending when we were the most organized trying to speak for some of the people in this country. So I think we need to not only have public financing elections, but break up these banks. And I actually, you know, to money and power is that one of the ways, and this is a traditional American way to deal with the problem of money and power, is you change the campaign finance system, but you also take it out at its root and make sure that we have decentralized power instead of this concentrated power.
So looking at the money that's coming into this thing, $2 billion sounds like a lot of money, because it is a lot of money. But to put it into a little bit more context, in the same year, 2012, Americans spent about $2.7 billion on Halloween candy.
Mm.
For one day.
Temptation.
Oh, but the nature of temptation. So looking at all of the money that goes in, some would argue there's not a problem. Money is speech, and if we take away that money, we take away people's right to support who they would like to support.
Well, I'm all politics are local. Let's go back a little bit. The first question you asked really had to do with what is the impact on the average day citizen? Well, over time, right, given this phenomenon we're discussing, money and power, over time, the constituency began to internalize that they are without power, mm-hmm. right? They therefore believe government does nothing for them. It's of no value. And consequently, they do not participate in political activities right. and so forth, right? Beyond that, there becomes an over-reliance on individual elected officials to represent them with very little accountability. Because it's hard for them to figure out how to deal with all of this big issue, mm-hmm. they focus on how can I deal with it in my community, and my elected official will protect, preserve, and so I don't have to do anything.
An over-reliance on the government officials. Well, so just while we're here, there's one person who's currently elected in an office. So I want to ask you, if you are in office right now representing people, does that apathy make it easier to do your job, or does it make it tougher to do your job in a real world way?
So a couple of points. The chart that you showed, that represents not just the 1%, but 1% of the one percenters.
Yeah.
The $2 billion right. who basically hijacked our government. Mm-hmm. Two, currently right now, there is a rule in the SEC, which obviously controls our retirement funds. And the GOP, the Republicans, the good old party, they're basically suing to overturn a rule which would protect pension dollars because they want money managers to invest in politics. My office has filed an amicus to protect pension dollars. But the point is that there are interests out there in the Republican Party. Their argument in their papers, they basically say, well, how are we going to raise money unless these, you know, money managers invest in our campaigns? And that's why we should overturn this decision by SEC, because it represents a violation of the First Amendment. I disagree, and we filed an amicus. And I hope all of you join me in that litigation. Three, my first meeting this morning was I was served on a panel focusing on homelessness. I can tell you there was 200 people at Baruch this morning. There were no lobbyists. They were the homeless. And then I left and went and spoke about childcare and what's happening to childcare centers, particularly the one in Brooklyn, not too far from here, which faces closure because of the threat of gentrification and market-driven factors. There were no lobbyists in that room. Oil is to Texas as real estate is to New York City. And so what we find on the steps of City Hall, on the steps of Washington, and even in Albany, are the influence of lobbyists over and over and over again in the face of elected officials trying to influence policy. Yeah. And so to answer your question, I'm not dismayed by apathy. I try to motivate and encourage individuals. And I must say, when I ran for office, I got the highest number of votes of anyone in the city of New York, despite the fact that every newspaper opposed me because they don't want a voice representing the interests of the homeless and children and working people in the city of New York. And what we need are more elected officials in the spirit of Al Vann and others who can talk about issues that people care about, bread and butter issues. I want my child in child care. I want affordable housing, and I want a permanent home for individuals who are homeless, as opposed to these quick fixes. And that's why we've got to inspire people and let them know that government can be an instrument and a tool for good, as opposed to evil and corruption.
So, Dick, I want to go to you. The public advocate has this fire and this position and those votes, but she also has a $5 million budget that doesn't look exactly very formidable next to billions of dollars. I gave you an extra million. She's got a $4 million budget that pits up against interest that may not be in the best
interest. But like a woman, we're doing a lot with it.
So it's not a fair fight. how does your group help to even those scales?
Well, specifically the Public Advocates Office, we have always argued that the Public Advocates Office should have a larger budget. And thankfully, to be given a little bit more authority, actually, too. Not only more money, but more authority. And, you know, thankfully, you know, under the current mayor, who was the previous public advocate,
right.
The current public advocate's budget has been raised, but we believe that it should be tied to a percentage of some other agency's budget so that it would grow naturally. And it's not subject to the political whims or the desires right. of who's the mayor or who's the city council speaker. I think what's important to emphasize what the public advocate is saying is that, you know, our city is succeeding in a way that maybe New York is broken. In a way that Washington is broken, and that with campaign finance, you know, where we have public funding of elections. Just consider a couple facts. In New York State, where we do not have public funding of elections, right. and we need comprehensive campaign finance reform, competition for state legislative seats is very, very low. Yeah. You know, in because of public campaign financing, three times as many incumbents in the city council were challenged than they are in the state legislature. There are far more candidates that run for the right. city council than do in the state legislature. And it shows not just that, you know, public funding can counteract the influence of big money, but it can also inspire and motivate people to become involved. Our city council is a very representative body of the neighborhoods and communities that make up the city. It has evolved over the last 20 years, ever since campaign finance was put into effect. And so we see, you know, more neighborhood leaders and community activists joining. If you look at those that joined the council, I mean, it's refreshing yeah. to see. The unfortunate thing is that there still is, you know, moneyed interests that are operating now outside of the system. These independent expenditure campaigns.
City council had the largest number of lobbyists in history donating money this year. Mm.
That's true. I mean, the one thing, however, is that their influence is less than it would be yes. of the average citizen. Because if you're a city 16. Lobbyist or if you are someone who does business with the city,
right.
you cannot have your contribution cannot be any more than $400 right. to a citywide candidate, and it's not matchable. And so right. it does even empower the smaller donors because their gifts or their contributions are still matched.
Yeah, I'd like to speak. You know, there is a limit to the power of the public advocate, but there's no limit to the power of the people.
That's right.
And so, you know, even such a small percentage are participating, but those few who understand that advocacy and protest is a significant part of the political system, and that advocacy and protest can create an atmosphere mm-hmm. for change, right? We've seen, I guess, the greatest example of our time is Dr. King, Reverend yes. Dr. King, and the movement that we're right. celebrating our 50 years anniversary. The movement was a movement of people in the street. And that led to the Voting Rights Act and a lot of other legislation that was for our people. So that there are levels where we can get things done for the right people in the right places, and they can get some things done. But until we are able to move the people en masse, we will always coming back for these town discussions, trying to figure out what can we do to make the change. Yeah. So when we get to the part where we're dealing with reform, okay, then I have some other ideas I'd like to throw out.
Well, on our way to reform, maybe we should talk about revolt a little. Ted, you are in front of folks. You were down, along with the public advocate, down in Zuccotti with the people who are occupying Wall Street. Why haven't we seen a sustained, just movement of people who have had a I'm mad as hell moment? Mm. Where is that energy and action as we sit here in 2015 now?
Well, I would disagree. I think we do have a sustained movement, and it's morphing and taking various forms. Mm-hmm. But the energy that coalesced at Zuccotti Park and then was violently crushed by the police department and the Department of Homeland Security, you know, this thing that where these people say to me, "What happened to Occupy? Why did it fizzle out?" It didn't fizzle. Things don't fizzle out in America. They're crushed by the powers that be because they see the potential for an uprising. So what I would say is that it hasn't fizzled. It hasn't gone away. It's taken other forms, such as the Fight for 15, which is coming up on April 15th. all of the things that the public advocate was speaking about, people that don't have a voice, low wage workers, the LGBT community. And what's heartening to me is that a lot of these movements are being led by just those folks, by women. So I'm heartened by, you know, these movements that are going on throughout the country, that, you know, people may say what happened to Occupy, but if you look around, Occupy may have sparked a thousand other little things and made activism potent again. Mm.
Doug, you write about this stuff all of the time. How do you sort of hold up a mirror and let people know that they might feel just a little comfortable? They might not have slept outside during Occupy, but they're still among the 99.
Mm. Yeah, well, you know, the Occupy moment was so exciting for me because I've been writing about this sort of thing for, you know, 25 years and nobody paid any attention. And then suddenly Occupy happened and then everybody paid attention. And it really, at least for a moment, really changed the political discourse in this country. And but really, for a small group of people, it really had an enormous effect. But the problem, one of the problems, certainly it was crushed, but that's part of the problem. You know, there's no way that the city government or the NYPD was going to let people stay in a park for very long. I consider myself part of the Occupy movement. I don't think there's any formal requirements for membership. Need to think about, you know, long-term issues of organization and demands. And people were very shy about organization and demands around the Occupy movement. They thought it was corrupting. You know, power corrupts, I guess. But you can't contest for power without organization and demands. And I think certainly we have to credit the repression part of the end of Occupy, but also we have to think about how something like that can institutionalize itself for the longer term and really fight powerful forces. You know, we're in a situation where inequality now breeds inequality. There's so much money at the top. You know, that $2 billion, there are hedge fund guys who pull in $1.5 billion a year. So we were talking about one and a half hedge fund guys' entire composition. You know, the Goldman Sachs bonus pool is, what, $8, $10 billion a year? So, you know, for Wall Street, this is tiny, tiny amounts of money. And as there's more and more money collects at the top, so does power, and so does political power. And people then get the feeling that they have everything is going to be decided for them. There's no popular influence over public policy, so why bother? And that's, you know, you see this low turnout, this disengagement. And Occupy turned that around for a little while because people felt like something was happening and they might have a voice and might contest for power. But we have to think about how to translate that popular spirit of uprising into something longer term.
Zephyr.
Well, one really exciting thing that happened recently is the FCC chairman announced that we are supporting a net neutrality policy. Yay. In the United States, which is something that the public advocate has been a huge leader on. And there were a lot of people who came out of Occupy who were involved in that. And it was an incredible blending of different kind of tactics. You saw people encamping themselves outside the FCC commissioner's offices so that they were very aware of the presence, that they're not going to go away. Be physical, be bird dogging, be there. You saw an incredible combination of people come together who don't usually organize together, but working with each other. Color of Change played a central role, yep, in the leadership in getting net neutrality passed. And then you saw basically 5% of the people who voted in the last election, that number, put in a comment to the FCC. There are 4 million comments to the FCC, which is an unheard of number. So people were not voting, but were making comments to the FCC. So it's this combination, and I actually think you saw a lot of the connections that came out of Occupy building power around net neutrality. Now, you know, next step is stopping the Comcast-Time Warner merger. Yeah. Next step is, you know, actually breaking things up. You know, this is just the beginning. But this should not have happened. The FCC chairman was a former lobbyist for the cable industry. This is not something, we did a power map a year ago and we're like, it's impossible, but let's try it. And I was just sort of around for the meetings. But I watched something incredible happen there, and that should, I think, give us hope that it's possible.
Mr. Moderator, I think we have an example before us. I think I heard on the radio today, wow, I'm dating myself. No, I have radio in my car, that's right.
Hey, okay. We're listening on WBAI. That's right.
The day or yesterday that in Ferguson, Missouri, right, they elected 3 blacks to serve on the city council, which is half of that council.
That's right.
And so I mean, there is a significant role for power protests, but it has to lead to the real power. As I said earlier, it will get you the attention that you need. It will inform some people that need to be informed. And we can connect that, hopefully, with those in power to make those changes. I'm a protest person. I believe in it. But I understand it has to have more to it after you get their attention.
Right.
We have to move that to where Ferguson has moved it, to putting people in power that actually represent the people, who are the people.
So, you know, and so, Brian, you have certain events spark movements.
Yeah.
And so in Ferguson, what we all witnessed 2 days ago, Mr. Scott in South Carolina, the fact is that it's a majority-minority community, but yet the police force is over 80% white, or I think it's even 90%. And what happened here in New York City with Eric Garner, Akai Gurley, and the list goes on. I mean, there's all these efforts now to transform and reform our criminal justice system, to provide sunlight into the criminal justice system, and trying to change how police officers respond to incidents in a non-lethal way. So, you know, I am drunk on hope. You know, I wake up every morning drunk with a hangover on hope. And I know that what Dr. King said, that there's nothing more powerful than the pat, pat, pat of feet marching. And so we must continue to march, we must continue to raise our voices, and we must continue to organize.
So in the spirit of that organization, and knowing the news about the turnout and the way that things may be changing in Ferguson, at least representationally, I have this some stats here about voters and how they don't trust the government. So in 1964, 29% of voters believed that the government was, quote, run by a few big interests looking out for themselves. Let's fast forward to 2013, and that number was at about 79%. Those numbers are according to the Gallup Foundation. And just looking at this, I internalized that for a second and thought, you know what, the people who I vote for generally have jobs in elected office now. The people I back usually win. But the problems that I still need to see addressed linger. We all waited in line for Obama to vote in 2012, and we're still faced with the same problems. So how do we continue to engage folks to say, well, voting is the answer if the structures remain, but the players just change?
Voting is only one part of it. You need to maintain the popular pressure on the elected officials.
Right.
They need to know that they won't get reelected if they don't do the right thing. You need that kind of energy. And don't just be satisfied that, you know, when you leave the polling booth, your job is done. That's only one small part of the whole process of how to transform society.
I don't know if we fully understand the depth of the problem. There is nothing that can be done in a month, a year, or 2 years, or some event that's going to all of a sudden make people believe in their government and come out and vote. If you understand what their lives have been, what they've gone through, how they have arrived at this feeling that government is not for them, how are you going to overcome that to get them to vote? Yeah, sometimes we'll get behind a personality. We'll get behind President Obama. You know, we'll get behind a Jesse Jackson. We'll get behind a Clinton. You know, there are individuals that we will support. But once that person gets in, everybody go back to their normal way of thinking and living. So we have to look at, in the long range, what do we do to get people to buy into their own government, their own looking out for themselves? How do they participate?
Right.
Let me offer a few ideas that I can't remember. I'm getting too old to remember shit.
I know.
Right? There are a few elements that I consider important if you're going to restore and sustain a democracy. And you'll be surprised what they are. No, you won't be. There must be an informed and an engaged citizenry. There's no way around it, not in a participating democracy. There has to be an expectation. There has to be an expectation of integrity and an adherence to some moral standards. We expect nothing, and that's what you're getting, nothing. I believe we have to professionalize the elected officials, and I'll get to details on that in a minute. And I think that there needs to be stricter penalties for those who betray the trust and those who violate those laws. Mm-hmm. have the four. Let me go forward a little bit.
That was
now,
the four?
There's more. Now, those were important elements, but how do we move those elements? I think that home, school, church, all must adhere to some kind of higher standard of morality. I mean, you just can't all of a sudden everybody gonna get religion here, right? It has to come from the community. It comes from the home. It comes from the church. It comes from the school. They all have to say, hey, we have to act in a certain way. It has to be a certain sense of morality. Schools, in addition to academic preparedness, they have to encourage independent thinking.
Critical thinking.
You know, we get led to the slaughter because we're not thinking for ourselves. And where are we going to get it? If the schools, rather than preparing for the test, let's teach our kids how to think independently. Schools must acknowledge and encourage personal integrity, and they must teach for them to understand the political system that they live under.
So
what it's all about.
To talk, I'm your next, Dick, but to give some context to talk about that morality, there is a great quote, and I'm sorry if I'm quote heavy today, but like I told you, I'm recently converted, so I've made lots of notes last night. Thomas Edsel in the New York Times in one of his op-eds wrote that the best politicians are sensitive to the relative importance of moral considerations as they shift from the public arena to the back room, aware that ultimate judgment of what they have done will be based more on what they produce than how they produce it, which boils down to the ends justifying the means. Why would your group have a problem with the roads being paved if someone got their hands greased a little bit if your way is made a little smoother to where you're going?
Well, I mean, people have to have faith in the way in which decisions are made. You know, they may want to see a certain outcome, and people will support a different outcome if they feel like they can be allowed to participate in it. I mean, if we wanted to, if you look at the way voting takes place in this country, there are so many barriers that exist to democratic participation. In New York State, in most states, you can vote on a Tuesday. You know, now if we want to go shopping, we don't have to go to the mall. We don't have to go to the corner store. We can go online and order it. Why can't we go online and vote? Why can't we here in New York State mail in our ballot? Why can't we not remove the barriers that exist to people's participation in our democracy by creating it, making it easier to vote? We wonder why people aren't voting. I mean, if you want to create a system that discourages voting, have it on one day when people are working.
That's right.
You know? And what I'm increasingly concerned about, and I think probably all of us are, is the movement in this country toward voter ID laws.
Right.
To suppress people from participating in exercising their right to vote. And the courts are beginning to uphold some of these laws, and it's alarming. And, you know, if we cannot, we not only have to take the money out of our political system with public campaign financing, we've got to also begin to open up the process of voting in order to make it easier to vote. Otherwise, people are going to be discouraged from voting.
That's right. That's right. So, Brian is right. We need early voting in the system. We also need to overturn Citizens United and McCutcheon. Period. We also need ethics reform on the state level and on the federal level. And we need disclosure. I don't understand why someone would be opposed to disclosing your clients, particularly if they're doing business with the state of New York. To me, that doesn't make sense. We also need to make state elected officials a full-time job and pay them appropriately. That's what we need more than anything else.
I want to sort of connect these different things. I think, you know, the different comments are connected in a way, and Tish, if I may.
Sure, I'm
public advocate.
No, Tish.
Tish. Tish's story earlier about what she did this morning is really powerful. And she can do that in part because in New York City, we have a public financing system so that she knows that when she runs for office, she just needs broad public support. She doesn't need big money support. Now, if she was running for Congress, she'd be spending 70% of her time sitting in a small room, calling up that 0.1% of 1% and asking them for money. And she wouldn't be listening to people who are homeless people. And she wouldn't be listening to people who want to talk about child care. And she wouldn't actually even know what is happening. And that is all legal. this private financing system is all legal. So we don't have penalties for people who take private money in elections. We call that the way we elect people. So I think that actually leads to an erosion of the morality of public servants. Because in some ways, these campaign contributions are the gateway drug to bribes. You get used to calling people up and telling them what they need to hear in order for them to give you $2,000. Then your own internal moral fabric gets used to doing the bidding of that 0.1% of 1%. So maybe when it comes around and it's something a little more illegal, it doesn't seem like it's any different. Why is it different to take something, you know, or to take a job later, totally legal, take a job as a lobbyist later? Yeah. So it makes you feel like your daily job is already so corrupted, so what difference does it make? And that's why I believe, along with Public Advocate, and I think most people here, that we can't accept private financing anymore because it corrupts the heart of our elected officials, too.
Yeah, and I would
this process has been underway for like 40 years, right? With the liberalization of rules on PACs that started in the 70s. This is a process. It's taken us 40 years to get to this point, right? It's going to take a little while to undo it.
Yeah, and I would just say, too, that as we're headed towards 2016, it's almost even more farcical because it looks like potentially we're setting up for a Bush-Clinton election. So when you talk about engaging with voters and stuff, I think people are so disillusioned with this suffocated system where it's just, you know, you have to have access, which means money, to even run, you know. So I think especially the younger generation is so disillusioned by that whole process that's why you're seeing people in the streets. And hopefully, as you say, that will morph over time into getting entrenched into power and doing things legislatively. But I just think right now, the system is so absolutely corrupt and absolutely wholly owned. I mean, what we saw there really was a graph showing that there is no democracy in America. Right. Like, why do we even use that word anymore? Right. It's not a democracy. Democracy is by and for the people, and the money shows that it's neither by nor for the people. So that's why there's real anger, and I think you'll continue to see people in the streets.
These two political scientists, Gillens and Page, I can't remember their first names, did a study of a whole bunch of legislation over the years and found out that popular preferences had no effect on their final outcome. It was all the preferences of the 1%. So it just, like, done with rigorous numerical political science has proved that there is no democracy in America.
Well, when I'm running for political office, I found one thing to be true. The more people you have, the less money you need, all right? So I think there's a principle there somewhere. Mm. What percentage of the people in this country are registered to vote? Anybody know that number?
It's under 50%.
Very low. Of those that are registered, what percentage come out to vote? A third, maybe.
So hearing those numbers, is it a viable strategy to listening to Ted and then listening to you, Mr. Van, to say, you know what, it's a coronation, it's Bush versus Clinton again, it's really Soros versus Coke, who's going to spend the most money? Is it a viable option to say, you know what, I opt out. I'm not going to vote this time because does to the question, can your voice count?
Well, you can't do that because you have the information. You have to go with what you know. Mm-hmm. But there are people who do not have the information. It's the battle of the bullet, right? That if we concede that we are not able to find a way to educate our own people to understand what is in their best interest, and if you keep doing the same things the same way all over again and thinking something different is going to occur, We have to think preemptively. We have to think about how do we do things that we haven't done before. But if we do not find a way to move and educate and inform our own people, we will not win this war. We will lose this war. And at some point in time, as Malcolm X prophesies, it's going to become the bullet of the ballot. People have become so without. The poor, there's no way for them to express themselves, to let people know what their needs are. They're not getting a response. So what will they go to? If we can't direct that into the vote, right, into the ballot, where do we direct it? What do we expect will happen in this country?
So a person who's not any fan of reducing the amount of money that corporations can get to put into our elections and our democracy, George Will, I have something great that he said. It's great. The only constitutional way to reduce the amount of money invested in politics is to reduce the role of politics in the distribution of money. Well, he's no fan of big reform, but he's intent on shrinking your government, but this doesn't sound incomprehensible.
So you're going to ask the people in government to reduce their role.
But this is so powerful because it's a great and terrible quote.
Yeah.
And it sort of, as simply as possible, reflects this ideology that comes out of the Chicago School, the law and economics ideology, that basically says the distribution of goods should not be done through people coming together and deciding what kind of society we want to live in. All distribution of all goods should be done through a market. And I find it, first of all, it's naive. No markets don't have some kind of structure to enable them to work well. In fact, if you don't have structure, the markets get very distorted and the big banks win even if they aren't providing better services, right? But what it's leading to, it's influenced the Supreme Court. It's leading to this sense of we don't really need government. You see it in the Tea Party. But you actually see it even among liberals sometimes who want to give up on government. Say, we can just do this ourselves. But we have built something extraordinary. As broken as it is, there's an amazing tradition in this country of this idea of people coming together and saying, what should we do? Not what do I want?
Right.
But what should we do? And if we can hold on to that tradition and reject this idea that the market is going to solve all our education problems, the market's going to build the right. MTA all by itself, the market's going to...
That's a good point. Like, the allegation that an elected official has violated the law, done something wrong, becomes a big deal,
yep.
As it should. I would suggest that there's more corruption in Wall Street than there is in the legislative halls, right? But there's no focus there, right? Why? Because of the uniqueness of the role of the elected official. Now, I'm going to say this again. We're like fixing the edges. We're doing a little bit here, a little bit there. We're trying to stop there, stop there. If we do not find a way to educate our people, it will not be successful. There's no way around it. You can't avoid it. It's a participatory democracy. If the people are not participating, we cannot find a way to educate and inform and move our own constituency, then we will die by that rule.
So in that sense, who's doing it right? New York City, we sit here, we're very proud and puffed up that you get 6-to-1 money if you're running for a municipal office here. But let's take it to a higher elevation and look down. David Cameron runs the Conservative Party in the UK. He spent $150,000 to get his job. They campaigned for 6 weeks and they're not on television. What are they doing right that we are getting so wrong when campaigns go on for years and amount to coronation seemingly? Who's doing it right out there? Who can we point to domestically or abroad that we should say,
New York City is the model. It is the model. I mean, we should do away with runoff elections because in my election we spent, I don't know how much, millions of dollars, and I think
$13 million.
For the Office of Public Advocate, when in reality I won by 1% as a result of the election, but then in the runoff we won successfully. But the bottom line is I truly believe that New York City is the model, and we should look to New York City too. I believe initially I had reservations, but I've examined it across the city of New York. I support participatory budgeting in the city of New York. And I believe that we really need to have participatory budgeting, and we need to expand it. And, you know, you mentioned earlier, just like sausage, people need to see how we make sausage, even though it's nasty, ugly, and the reality is the same as with budgeting. We need more transparency in budgeting as opposed to, you know, three men in a room or behind closed doors or whatever. I think everyone needs to be involved, and they need to play some role in how your tax dollars are spent in the city, the state, and federal government.
So who's doing it right, Dick?
Well, I mean, you know, I think, you know, in Britain there are restrictions on speech in a way that there aren't necessarily here in the United States. But, You know, what I find odd is that there are no restrictions on candidates running for political office in the sense of how long they can run and what they can say, but there are restrictions on the voters in terms of their participation. You know, as Tish mentioned earlier, we should have early voting where people can vote for 10 days leading up to election. Where, you know, if you're not registered to vote, you should be able to show up to a voting booth that day and register to vote. Why do you have to register 30 exactly. days in advance in order to be allowed to exercise right. your constitutional right to vote? You know, and why do you have to be registered in a political party a year before in order to vote in that political party? Right. I mean, there are so many hurdles to our participation, that's but right. none to the candidates. I mean, I would favor flipping it. You know, right. put restrictions on the candidates as to how long they can run and put no restrictions on how voters can participate.
Yeah, because, you pose the question as what is wrong with the electorate.
Right.
I don't think there's anything wrong with the electorate. I think we put too many barriers in their way, and we don't make it convenient and easier for them to vote. And we need to realize that we're no longer dealing with a 9-to-5 society.
Yeah.
And so what we really need to do is embrace technology, vote on the internet, early voting, make registration easier. These rules are burdensome, and countless number of individuals have said to me that we need to remove the barriers, and that would increase participation
in
the electorate. To be clear,
the question was about systems,
okay.
saying like they seem to be on to something, and I'm always about the systems because, like I said, the people change, but the system remains.
Well, the system of people.
Yeah,
it's people in yeah. positions and office and so forth. And the expectation that I never thought that I would come to the point to realize that people in public office are more concerned about their being reelected and staying in office than they are about the people that they represent and people who come to this. And they're the ones that are going to have to make the change that you want
right.
in order to support the constituency. The answer cannot come from those in power.
Right.
The answer cannot come there because they wish to stay in power.
That's right.
I think it's interesting that a word that I don't think has come up yet, unless I haven't heard it, talking about systems, is capitalism. And capitalism is utterly broken and utterly suffocating people at every turn. And as someone who works in the arts, it's almost funny because, you know, it's not capitalism. It's crony capitalism. It's a perversion of whatever capitalism is supposed to be in the first place. But as someone who works in the arts, you know, we're not capitalists. Like, you know, we operate almost as socialists in everything that we do. I mean, I did a web series where it was funded through Kickstarter. Friends got involved. Right. And that's the way the economy works, not just for artists, but for poor people in general.
Right.
We look out for each other. We take care of one another. So this capitalist kind of system and ideology that we're bombarded with at every turn really is a lie in terms of, I think, how most people live their lives. And it's utterly broken, and I think people are done with it.
Mm. So it's funny, we teach young children to share and to be cooperative and not to be competitive and not to be aggressive. But at some point, you know, maybe when they hit puberty, they're supposed to get aggressive and competitive. So there's some way in which we think it's best. A society is best at which we encourage these virtues of sharing and cooperation, but somehow you have to grow out of that to function as a grown-up.
Dick wanted to make a point.
If we can, I mean, you know, you're talking about the rules and systems. If we can shorten the campaign season, I think a lot of us would be in favor of that. If we can extend, you know, so like having legislators run every 2 years, maybe extend the term to 4 years so they're not in perpetual re-election mode, as Mr. Vann has said. Right. You know, I think there are structural things that we can do. Yeah. That takes the politics out of it a little bit and allow people to make those decisions on behalf of the people.
I know you have.
And let me just say this.
Yeah, yeah.
In regards to what Councilmember Vann said, and Assemblyman Vann, he has a lot of titles, is we need to put civics back in school. We need to talk about the Constitution as opposed to high stakes tests. That's what and competition. We need a full rounded education. We need the arts. We need physical education, we need debate teams, we need all of that, as opposed to this emphasis and focus on high stakes tests. Teach children about government, teach children about civic, teach children about their local elected officials, how they have a responsibility to their community as a citizen of these United States. That's gone. It's gone.
Okay, but if we want to get there, so to answer your question about England, but if we want to get there, as you know, there's a great WNYC interview where Brian Lehrer asked, I think, Karen DeWitt, who does Andrew Cuomo think his constituency is in asking for more testing?
WBAI New York.
And it's not that people are in the streets protesting, demanding more testing for their kids. So the root issue, I believe that public education is the infrastructure of democracy.
But
if we want to get there, we also have to be very clear that the reason we are moving away and towards a privatized education system is because of the public financing system, and it is the one thing that we can do. So I believe in limiting how much you can spend on campaigns. Mm. I believe in a lot of the reforms they have in England, but our Supreme Court has said you can't do that.
Right.
You can't limit spending on campaigns. You can't do the kinds of limitations you see throughout all of Western Europe. So the few things we can do are our current Supreme Court has not struck down public financing. So if I sound like a broken record around public financing, it's because it's something we can do that can allow for people to support the kind of public education.
But it's a threat to our democracy as a whole. Not only the privatization of public education, the privatization of our public assets as a whole, from our libraries to our public square, to the crisis in affordable housing and the fact tonight there's 60,000 homeless sleeping in a shelter, in our shelters, a third of them children, most of those children who look like me. The reality is that we as an electorate have got to raise our voices about these issues, which are a threat to our democracy in this country.
Okay, we as an electorate, we elect the officials who are oftentimes complicit in the privatization of those things.
Right.
So I want to know from you guys what that looks like. You talked about the pitter patter of feet being joyous to MLK, and looking at incumbents and the way that they remain in office, the system is set up to favor an incumbent. Every time you show up, you're campaigning essentially, and it's hard to even get into the race, even with a 6-to-1 matching that we give in New York City. So how do we get people to vote against their own interest in order to get a new infusion of people in there who might have our best interest and be in touch with the community more than folks who may have gone to the other side, frankly, with the absolute power corrupting absolutely? What does that look like? What do we do marching from this place, and not marching, but leaving this place tonight? How do we make that happen?
Good question.
Well, I can say my own path is, I think, similar to a lot of people, voting and campaigning for President Obama in 2008, making calls, knocking on doors in Ohio, really excited about the potential for change. Then being disillusioned, realizing the difference between candidate Obama and President Obama, not entirely of his own doing or his own fault. We're talking about a system that's so broken that I just think the office is broken. And I think anyone who gets into that position is going to be hard pressed to make significant change. But just from to take it from the macro to the micro, I got involved with Occupy Wall Street. I got involved with various activism. And as was mentioned before, I got involved again. I became a student again. I became engaged with my own community again. We started Occupy Astoria, Long Island City, and we're currently building a community center and a library in our neighborhood. So I think the antidote to any type of despair, which is in no short supply, is to get involved and to find where you fit in and to do it on the micro level locally.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, because we're looking for this grand thing that we can do to make things different.
Right.
And there is no grand thing. It's almost like guerrilla warfare. You're going to have to start very local and build and build and grow and develop. And if that's happening all around, then you've got a possibility of something happening. But the idea that we can change the mentality of those who are now in office, and that somehow we can make them not want to accept the most motivating factor in America, which is money, is a little naive, I think. And I think someone has said education is the key, but how do we begin, how do we have the ability to affect what's happening in the public schools?
Well, what?
We know it's the answer, but so how do we?
The other structural thing is we have, in New York City and state government, we have a very strong executive. Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, if we want to change the power dynamic and make the legislatures and the city council more people-focused, we got to give the legislatures more power. And part of that is, you know, as Tish mentioned earlier, making the legislature a full-time job in Albany and putting a cap on the outside income that legislators can earn. It's worked in Congress in that you need to increase the salaries to attract a lot of people to run so that they can raise a family on a decent salary. You need to cap outside income so that those who are working for the state are not influenced by the very people that they're raising the money from to run their election campaigns. And so, you know, there are a lot of systemic changes that we can do, but the biggest change is to, you know, get off the sidelines and get involved, whether it's voting, organizing, you know, getting involved.
I don't know, using Congress as an example of where something is working is going to
benefit.
I take your point. We need to have a little competition, disagreement, just mix it up a little bit.
Right.
So one thing that I think is cultural, in general, I'm focused on systems.
Right.
You know, public financing, antitrust. We have way too strong an executive, which I know running for office because I'd talk to lawmakers and they'd say, I can't talk to you because it might affect my constituents. Right? That's a different way. But one of the biggest things that I think is generational and I want to crack and I don't know the answer to is there are so many politically engaged young people who will organize, who will march, who will give up a big money job to do social work, who will work at a nonprofit, and then if you ask them, will you run for office, they say, I'm not going to do that, that's kind of corrupt. So it is like they are taking the biggest weapon we have to take on organized power, which is not going to give up without a demand, and saying, I'm just not going to use that weapon. That's not cool. It's cool to organize. So I think it's really important to get people in to run for office and to use their power.
Right.
And they may not win, but to start to sort of bring those voices in, bring in the artistry of politics. We have this really anti-poetic current politics where everybody just delivers sound bites. Mm. Like really mix it up, who's running and how they're talking, and bring some more life into it.
That's right.
Well, speaking of bringing voices in, Doug, give me one second.
Okay.
We're going to bring some voices in just a moment. We have two microphones on either side of the stage here, and we encourage you guys, if you have questions, to make your way to the microphones right now, and we'll be getting to you in just a moment. So we're bringing the town into the town hall, and back to you, Doug.
I do kind of understand people's reluctance to run for office because they look at this system and see that it's so much larger than any individual, and that you're not going to march through the institution. The institution is going to march through you, and you're just going to end up being either corrupt or broken. And so I think people get very nervous about getting to that game because it seems the odds seem so stacked against them, which is why I think it's really important to keep popular movements outside, you know, the doorways of the elected officials and making them do the right thing to create that kind of pressure rather than looking for the right people to run for office because that might not really work for very long.
But you need both. I mean,
you do need both,
like,
yeah.
You can't just
I would agree
have
you need both, but, you know,
yeah.
I think, if anything, the keeping step, the popular pressure up is more important.
I think a major step is, see, the entire community, all the community institutions have to be involved in encouraging voter participation.
Yeah.
We leave it to the politicians, to the political clubs.
Yeah.
Well, if I'm a local politician and I got a small voter base and I can keep them informed and keep letting them know what I'm doing and so forth, I'll be reelected for life.
Yeah.
Because it's a very small voter base. I'm not necessarily motivated to increase it because then I'm risking who someone to take my seat.
Right.
But there has to be, in my judgment, the community has to buy into the system that they live in. Everywhere you go in your community, there should be voter education and encouragement to come out and vote. It has to be a community thing, not a few people out there saying, hey, let's vote.
Back to your point about removing barriers to voting. We're going to open our first question with you, sir. Tell us your name and your neighborhood, please.
Yes, my name is Thomas Lopez Pierre, and I live in Upper Manhattan, and I'm a candidate for city council in 2017, and I spend probably half my week on the phone begging for campaign contributions. My opponent has taken thousands and thousands of dollars from landlords. And when you consider gentrification and displacement, which has been seriously affecting the Black and Latino community, my question for the panel is, when can we get an educated electorate? Oh, but I take no real estate money. And you can't serve two masters. You can't fight for tenants and then fight for landlords. We don't want referees. We want advocates. And so my question is, what is the process? How can we get the electorate to be educated enough where taking a campaign contribution from a child molester is the same thing as taking a campaign contribution from a landlord? That so it's just perceived as so dirty that we wouldn't do it if you want to get elected.
Running for city council seat?
Yeah, he's running for city. You've trotted that path. So how do you do that to make the electorate realize?
A city council is a small enough political division that you can really run without having an awful lot of money. If